The struggles and conspiracies took their toll. Stalin often suffered tonsillitis when under pressure. The patient lay on a sofa with a high temperature for 5 days, surrounded by specialists and the Politburo. The doctors visited twice a day and kept vigil at night. By New Year's Eve, he was well enough to attend the party where the whole family danced together for the last time. Stalin was preparing for his most reckless gamble since collectivization, the massacre of Lenin's party. The legal melodrama opened on the 23rd of January and immediately expanded the terror to thousands of new potential victims. Radek, who may have been coached personally by Stalin, reveled in his black humor, joking that he was not tortured under interrogation. On the contrary, he had tortured his investigators for months by refusing to cooperate. Then he delivered what were probably Stalin's own lines. But there are, in our country, semi-Trotskyites, quarter-Trotskyites, one-eighth Trotskyites, people who helped Trotskyites, not knowing of the terrorist organization, but sympathizing with it. The message was clear and explains the crazy randomness of the terror. Those without blind faith were to die. 13 of the defendants, including Piatakov, were sentenced to death, but Radek received 10 years. In Moscow, 200,000 people, bedazzled by propaganda, massed in Red Square, despite temperatures of minus 27 degrees, bearing banners that read, "The court's verdict is the people's verdict." Khrushchev addressed them, denouncing the Judas Trotsky, a line that strongly implied that Stalin was the metaphorical Jesus. By raising their hand against Comrade Stalin, Khrushchev told the crowds, "They raise their hands against all the best that humanity has, because Stalin is hope, Stalin is our banner, Stalin is our will, Stalin is our victory." The country was swept by the emotional effervescence of hatred, fear, and bloodlust. Maria Svanitsa wrote in her diary that Radek's human baseness exceeded all imagination. These moral monsters deserved their end. How could we so blindly trust this band of scoundrels? Today it seems impossible that virtually every factory and railway line was being sabotaged by Trotskyite terrorists within their management. But Soviet industry was riddled with mistakes and cursed with accidents thanks to poor management and the breakneck speed of the 5-year plans. For example, in 1934 alone, there were 62,000 accidents on the railways. How could this happen in a perfect country? Enemies among the corrupt elite explained the failures. The arrest of saboteurs and wreckers in the industrial factories and railways spread. The staffs of Sevgo and Kaganovich were again hit hard. Stalin carefully prepared for the plenum that would formally open the terror against the party itself. On the 31st of January, the Politburo commissioned the two industrial kingpins to speak about wrecking in their departments. Stalin reviewed their speeches. Sergo accepted that wreckers had to be stopped, but wanted to say that now they had been arrested, it was time to return to normality. Stalin angrily scribbled on Sergo's speech, "State with facts which branches are affected by sabotage and exactly how they are affected." When they met, Sergo seemed to agree, but he quietly dispatched trusted managers to the regions to investigate whether the NKVD was fabricating the cases, a direct challenge to Stalin. Sergo and Kaganovich withdrew, like schoolboys to rewrite their essays. Stalin deliberately turned the screw. The NKVD searched Sergo's apartment. Only Stalin could have ordered such an outrage. Sergo, as angry and humiliated as intended, telephoned Stalin.
"Why are you upset?" said Stalin. "They can search my place at any moment, too."
Stalin summoned Sergo, who rushed out so fast he forgot his coat. He returned home in a very agitated state and started retyping his speech, then rushed back to Stalin, who taunted him more with his sneering marginalia. "Ha ha!" Sergo told his wife Zina that he could not cope with Koba, whom he loved. The next morning he remained in bed, asking that no one should disturb him. At 5:30 p.m., Zina heard a dull sound and rushed into the bedroom. Sergo lay bare-chested and dead on the bed. He had shot himself in the heart. Zina telephoned Stalin. Sergo's done the same as Nadia. Stalin banged down the phone at this grievous insult. Within half an hour, Stalin arrived from Kuntsevo to join the other leaders in Sergo's apartment. Again the Kremlin family mourned its own, but suicide left as much anger as grief. Zina sat on the edge of the bed beside Sergo's body. The leaders entered the room, looked at the corpse, and sat down. Voroshilov, so soft-hearted in personal matters, consoled Zina. "Why console me?" she snapped. "When you couldn't save him for the party." Stalin caught Zina's eye and nodded at her to follow him into the study. They stood facing each other. Stalin seemed crushed and pitiful. Betrayed again. "What shall we say to people now?" she asked. "This must be reported in the press," Stalin replied. "We'll say he died of a heart attack." "No one will believe that," snapped the widow. "Sergo loved the truth. The truth must be printed." A list of doctors signed the mendacious newspaper bulletin. At 17:30, while he was having his afternoon rest, he suddenly felt ill and a few minutes later died of paralysis of the heart. Stalin's obstacle had been removed. On the 23rd of February, the plenum opened under the pall of Sergo's death, Pyatakov's execution, the spreading arrests, and the bloodthirsty public effervescence whipped up by the media. If there was any moment when Stalin emerged as dictator with power over life and death, it was now. Yezhov opened with a savage indictment of Bukharin, who was on hunger strike. "I won't shoot myself," Bukharin replied, "because people will say I killed myself to harm the party, but if I die, as it were, from an illness, what will you lose from it?" "Blackmailer," shouted several voices. "You scoundrel," shrieked Voroshilov at his ex-friend. "Keep your trap shut. How vile, how dare you speak like that?" "It's very hard for me to go on living." "And it's easy for us?" asked Stalin. "You really babble a lot." "If you won't confess," declared Mikoyan, "you're just proving you're a fascist hireling." The hirelings were sent home. In Stalin and Nadia's old apartment, Bukharin worked frantically on a letter to a future Central Committee and posterity, asking his beautiful wife Anna, just 23, to memorize it. In his apartment just across the river, Rykov would only say, "They'll send me to prison." His wife had suffered a stroke as the attacks on her husband became more deadly. His devoted 21-year-old daughter, Natalia, helped him dress each day for the plenum, as her mother had done. The commission voted on their fate, and Bukharin and Rykov were summoned. Both faced the anguished panic and sad regrets of last goodbyes. Natalia helped her beloved father dress in suit, tie, waistcoat, and overcoat. He said nothing as they took the lift downstairs, walking out onto the embankment where a black limousine waited. Father and daughter turned to one another on the pavement. They awkwardly shook hands, then they kissed formally three times on the cheek. Without a word, he climbed into the car that sped off towards the Kremlin. Natalia never forgot that moment. "And I never saw him again, except in my dreams." When Paskryovichev phoned Bukharin, Anna began to say farewell. In that heart-rending moment of eternal parting, which was to be shared by millions in the coming years. Paskryovichev phoned again. The plenum was waiting, but Bukharin was in no hurry. He fell to his knees before his young Anna. With tears in his eyes, he begged forgiveness for my ruined life, but he begged me to raise our son as a Bolshevik. "A Bolshevik, without fail," he said twice. He swore her to deliver the memorized letter to the party. "You're young, and you'll live to see it." He then rose from the floor, hugged her, kissed her, and said, "See, you don't get angry, Anyutka. There are irritating misprints in history, but the truth will triumph. We understood, Anna wrote. We were parting forever. She could only say, see that you don't lie about yourself. But this was much to ask. Pulling on his leather coat, he disappeared into the alleyways around the great Kremlin palace. At the plenum, Stalin proposed that they be handed over to the NKVD. Does anyone wish to speak? Andreev asked. No? Are there any other proposals beside the one made by Comrade Stalin? No? Let's vote. All those against? None. Any abstentions? Two. So the resolution carries with two abstentions, Dukharin and Rykov. The two who had once ruled Russia alongside Stalin were arrested as they left the plenum. One minute, Dukharin was living in the Kremlin with cars, dachas, and servants. The next minute, he was passing through the gates of the Lubyanka, handing over his possessions, being stripped, having his rectum checked, his clothes returned without belt or shoelaces, and then being locked in a cell with the usual stool pigeon to provoke him. But Dukharin was not tortured. Dukharin's Anna and Rykov's half-paralyzed wife and daughter, Natalia, were arrested soon afterwards, serving almost two decades of slave labor. Anna did not see her baby son, Yuri, again for 20 years. This uglier meeting dealt other blows, too. Yezhov attacked Yagoda. Molotov, giving Selgo's report, cited 585 wreckers in heavy industry. Kaganovich ranted about the unmasking of enemies on the railways. Stalin made use of a half-mad crone and party busybody, Polya Nikolayenka, who had denounced the Ukrainian potentate Postyshev. Stalin hailed her as a simple member of the party, treated by Postyshev like an annoying fly. Sometimes the simple people are much closer to the truth than certain higher examples. Postyshev was moved to another job, not arrested. The warning was clear. No Politburo prince and his family group were safe. We old members of the Politburo were soon leaving the scene, Stalin explained ominously. It's the law of nature. We would like to have some teams of replacements. Stalin, politician and man, was brilliantly equipped for the constant intensification of struggle which he formulated into his creed of terror. The further we move forward, the more success we have. The more embittered will the remnants of the destroyed exploiter classes become, the sooner they will resort to extreme forms of struggle.